consideration, but nobody really thought that was an essential thing for DuPont to do at that point in time. But Conoco looked good to us, and our projections of what was going to happen to crude prices, and which weren't true, and how it might, the synergy might work. I'd say most of that turned out as we saw it. The really good news in the Conoco acquisition was that the Conoco people were a very good fit with the bond. And the business was not one that we didn't understand. We didn't pretend to know where to look for oil or or how the market would behave in the future, but we did know it was an important business. We found out that we've gotten in bed with very good people, and we did think it would be countercyclical, which it has turned out to be. When the oil company has a good year, the chemicals don't necessarily. So we've smoothed out the earnings curve very nicely, and it's just been a very successful marriage. And I think if you talk with the Conoco people, you get pretty much the same story. If DuPont had not acquired Conoco, I do not think Conoco would have lasted very long as a freestanding company. And if an oil company had picked them up, obviously their ranks would have been thinned quite a bit. But that's a different kind of marriage.
Yes. Did you have much selling to do with the executive committee?
The committee was came together very nicely at the end of the day. There were some concerns in the committee whether we really wanted to do this, and some conviction that we didn't have to. And I think both were valid positions. But at the end of the day, Jeff made it very clear, look, gang, whether you're going to unite on this thing and do it as a happy family, or we're not going to do it. And put that way, the committee felt, well, on balance, we ought to go ahead. And it wasn't a hard sell, particularly, but when you do something on that scale, everybody better be reasonably comfortable with it. Otherwise, it's you better not do it. And I think we reached that level of comfort fairly easily.
Let's come back to R&D at all. What was R&D's perception of this? How did they react to it?
They probably thought we'd lost our minds, at least some of them, but I think when they got a chance to think about it, there was no great concern. Nobody perceived this as a threat. At least they shouldn't have. Conoco's R&D turned out to be pretty good. Obviously different, but they had some capabilities which we took advantage of, some good summer works facilities and things like that, and there really was quite a bit of synergy between the two companies that was uncovered as we lived together, and a lot of trading of product back and forth, so it turned out very well.
Were there other possibilities considered before Conoco? I mean, when you start
other
looking
kinds
at this?
Of ventures, we started to build a refinery, and we had a project on the table which the finance committee turned down. Would have been late 60s, early 70s. We had various long-term contract arrangements with suppliers. We kept poking at it because we were concerned about the cost of raw materials and the availability of raw materials, and concerned that the tremendous cash flow generated by businesses like that could lead to some people that were very well financed and competitors in chemicals. So, you know, a little bit of a, maybe I better have one foot in this boat just in case it turns out to be the way to get into certain things we want to do. So there were a lot of reasons like that. And we had worried over the issue for about 10 years, so we were not approaching it cold.
Okay. In 86, then, Jefferson retired, and you finally did I think I read a quote from Shapiro who said if he had had his way, he would have liked to have seen you in that position earlier.
I didn't hear that. Yeah, I know, but that doesn't belong in this discussion.
Okay. Around that time, I'm quoting again, his passion is marketing and he is revamping a company that has always emphasized R&D. Wall Streeters say his strategy has helped make DuPont healthier than it has been in years.
Well, that's very generous, but a lot of people worked on that. And that was just a natural evolution of the company that I and my predecessors have been trying to change for 20 years. I go back to the word partnership. I never worked with a chairman that I didn't feel was my partner. That starts with McCoy and Shapiro and Jefferson, certainly, and I think Woolard would say the same thing. It's a continuum. And so, I had the best part of the ride, I have to tell you, because those 3 years were pretty good. But that, not because I was that much different from anybody else, but because that's where we were in this evolution. Woolard, on the other hand, caught the period when the economy went sour and when downsizing and cost cutting were the name of the game. So you take the oars when they're given to you, and you row the waters that you that you have. So I think if you talk with any one of us, as you have and will, you'd discover that each of us has enormous respect for the contributions of others along the way, and we're a little reluctant to take credit for much of anything except not letting it get out of control. But we all felt good about those years because we had been working in that direction for a long, long time, and a lot of the things that each of us individually and collectively had stressed were beginning to pay off.
Mm-hmm. The message you sent to employees, and we mentioned this earlier, is that the breakthrough products once sold themselves, but now marketing is crucial because of the competition is stronger.
That's very true.
And the quote, your quote was, "We have to learn to win without all the aces."
Yeah, that's very true. Exactly what I said.
How did people respond to that?
Well, marketing people loved it. Technical people might have been slightly bruised, but I think they understood where we were, and manufacturing likewise. No, that was not a problem. That really worked into the concept that I've been stressing with all our senior managers. You know, you fellas can make the difference. It's not going to be just product or just anything else. It's how we run this business, and you're the guys that make the calls. You can have an enormous impact on what happens.
You also attacked the inward focus at management retreats.
Consistently. And appropriately, in my view. Yeah, you fall in love with what you're doing internally, you forget that the customer, when he buys product, he wants to pay for product and nothing else. He doesn't want to pay for a large this or a large that has no value to him. He wants to pay for value, and for goods received or services received. And people who work in large organizations are in grave danger of falling in love with what they do, and expanding their part of the enterprise becomes the number one goal, whereas that may or may not be good for the business. So you really have to look outside and ask, does the customer give a damn about what I do? And if he doesn't, should I have this job? You know? I even told our legal people, if you can't see some reason why you're useful to the customer, then you've got a problem. Every one of these divisions, in fact, does in one way or another serve the customer. But the question of how much the customer wants to buy of that is one we have to constantly keep in front of us. And so that really was a thrust, you know. Just remember, if the value isn't there, in fact, or at least perceived, we have a problem.
Another quote, in just over a year, Heckert has bought $1 billion worth of new businesses and peeled away layers of management to get executives closer to their customers.
That was, had been going on for quite some time. Those businesses, some were okay, some weren't. At least they weren't total winners.
Did you have a strategy in what you were looking for?
Most of the acquisitions we made, other than Conoco, were generated at departmental level. The interest in them was generated at departmental level, usually with prior discussion with the executive committee on, you know, logical ways to expand the business. So, I've forgotten exactly which. I think we had three in that period of time. And they were largely departmental initiatives supported in principle by the committee.
Something we also just talked about, but another quote, management by committee can lead to hardening of the corporate arteries.
Yeah.
And I think this was the time when the relationship of the members of the executive committee changed. It was less advisory, more direct.
That's correct.
And was that your doing?
Well, it started under Jeff. And but it was a continuum again. But we had long discussions about what the committee really ought to be. I had some problem with that. My problem was not that the committee members couldn't run the businesses, but I worried about whether or not we could maintain what I had worked so hard, along with Jeff and others, to build in the way of committee relationships. When nobody has any special stake in any of the departments, then it's easy for us to come together as a managing group because we're not protecting turf. There are no turf issues between us. I question whether, if we went to a straight line management arrangement, whether we would maintain this rather extraordinary climate that had developed over about two or three decades, which DuPont didn't always have. But we had learned to disagree without being disagreeable, and we respected one another, and we really were clicking about that time as a management team at the committee level. I thought we disciplined the committee and made certain changes in relationships with the rest of the company so that the committee system had finally gotten close to perfection, or at least it was much better than it had been in a long time. And so here we were deciding to change now that we finally learned how to do it. And that bothered me a little bit, but I've not, as I've lived with the change, it has not turned out to be a problem. But it is important. And you see this again and again, and as you look at what happens to some companies, well, the top three or four people don't get along very well. That can lead to a real disaster. It's an enormous distraction, and I think it's an impediment to making good decisions. And so I wanted to preserve that with no question in my mind that the members of the committee would be very good at running the individual pieces of the company. I had no problem with that concept at all, but I did want to preserve the ambiance that we had worked so hard to create. And I think that was largely done. That was my only concern about the change.
At one point, automotive products, talking about getting closer to the customer, the automotive products group moved to Detroit. And
right.
actually led to new developments because they were in closer contact with...
Excellent to see.
Which brought them almost back neck and neck with GE. I don't know where they are today. This is a few years ago, but...
I'd say we've evened it up a bit. I really don't know either. I'm not close to the numbers anymore, but we're a player for sure.
Was this moving of groups out of, let's say, out of this area to being closer to their customer like the automotive group, was that your decision?
I don't recall whose decision it was, but it was a kind of thing that departments were talking about as a result of this focus on customers and markets. And we had a fairly large presence out there. We recognized that untenable aspects of the old arrangement was we had the pot people out there calling on GM that didn't know one another, and sometimes buying for the same piece of the business. And you know, that just got to be a ridiculously inefficient way to do it. And we began putting special laboratories out there and finally concluded that the whole business ought to go out there. So we had a finishes development, color development, paint development laboratory out there, and we had a large plastics contingent. And finally we said, why in the hell do we have all those people out there and not the boss? And we stick him out there where he belongs and see if we can't get a little better coordination. And as a consequence, our service to automotive improved very dramatically. I don't remember who first said the words, but it had been taking place piecemeal for a number of years, and everybody knew that this was right. That's one of the problems with the committee system. Nobody can remember who said it first, and nobody cares.
One thing we haven't mentioned, and I'm not familiar with DuPont's role in global ventures and when that occurred.
Well, we had invested in North and South America 60 or 70 years ago. I've forgotten how old those units are now, but we've been outside the U.S., Canada and Mexico and Argentina, Venezuela, for a long, long time, a little bit of activity in Europe and virtually nothing in the Far East. About 1960, we began to realize that the Pacific Rim is going to be very important, and I think in the next several years, we established five or six joint ventures in Japan, which is the only thing that was available to us at that point, and began pushing hard in Europe. Not just with marketing, but with manufacturing facilities and all the other service aspects of the business. So that I'd say DuPont became a, quote, international company somewhere around the beginning of the 60s. It was clear then that Europe was going to be a very big and important economic area, and the Pacific Rim also, and so it was time to get going.
During your term, what was happening in the international area during your term?
Well, we were growing, probably a little faster in the Pacific than we were in Europe, but we were growing in all these different areas, and I was spending a lot of time on international aspects of the business. We were predicting that by the middle of this decade or shortly thereafter that more than half of our business would be outside the U.S. Don't hold me exactly to that frame and that number, but it's roughly that, I think. And certainly that by the turn of the century we'd have a bigger stake outside than inside the U.S. And that's continued. So that's another one of those things that nobody in recent generations started, but we've all worked hard on, and Willard's working very hard on it today. with good results and a very good reason.
Another aspect was your willingness to go outside for talent, outside the company for talent. For example, somebody from IBM was hired. He had designed a process of creating ceramic circuits, and you wanted to get into that technology and actually hired somebody away from IBM. Were there other examples of that, and how was that received?
Well, there were a few in pharmaceuticals and some new areas of R&D related to life sciences, primarily, and some, I guess, in the computer area. We had concluded that, you know, it's fine to grow your own management when that's possible, but if that becomes a limitation on human resources, that's dumb. So somewhere along the, I'm sure this doesn't go way back, I just don't know because I wasn't there, but ever since I've been on the committee, we've been willing to go outside, and I would say we became more and more impressed with the importance of going outside if you're getting into some area that you don't know very well. And you're really, the most dangerous thing you can do is acquire a business that you don't really understand, serving a market that you don't really understand. That's really a dangerous step. So you've got to bring people in that know the story.
Well, again, I'm quoting, and this is 1986, but Heckert may not be able to bring in enough new blood to make a difference.
Well, that's a...
it's an analyst viewpoint.
Yeah, I never really handled the analyst very well, in my view, because the analyst didn't really recognize what my agenda was, and my agenda wasn't very saleable. We'd been through a period of enormous change, and it was continuing. And I knew I had 3 years and no more. And my view of life was, let's give DuPont a breather. Let's do everything that we're doing now that can make the business better. But let's not thrash around and try to reinvent the company in a three-year period. I was much more concerned with making sure that Woolard got off to a fast start and that he had every opportunity to test himself before he took over, because he was clearly the heir apparent. And so I didn't do what a lot of people who have the prospect of serving 5 or 10 years do, that is reinvent the company in my own image and set out to make it happen. In the first place, I've been part of the management team for 13 years already. And I identified myself completely with where DuPont was and where DuPont was going. I'd had 13 years to influence the process. And if I wasn't happy with it, there must have been something wrong with me. So why should I, on the beginning of my term, come out with a bunch of new pronouncements about what DuPont was and where it ought to go? I didn't feel that. I thought we were headed in a very good direction. And in any case, I wasn't going to be around long enough to make any huge difference. Now, you know, you can evaluate that attitude any way you choose. I think it was realistic. And in any case, I really was not dissatisfied with where we were or where we were headed, and I was very anxious to see us continue some of the changes that were underway without interruption, without distraction. And we had 3 very good years. So in my view, that was just the right approach. Woolard had every opportunity to think long and hard about what he wanted to do, and so he came to the chair with plenty of preparation and really with a head start on doing what he wanted to do, which is just the way it should have been. So I think both transitions were smooth. Jeff, to me, was easy, and for me, the Lord was smooth and positive, and no rancor, no philosophical difficulties.
Which is very important for a company that's undergoing transition to have
I think so. I never, I never apologize at all for my view of life, but the analysts don't think that's very impressive. Christ, here's a guy who's new in the chair and he doesn't want to turn the company upside down. What's the matter with him? Might be just that he has good sense.
I hadn't realized, though, that I think it's an interesting point that the experience you have on the executive committee for all those years really puts you in a different position when you take over as opposed to somebody who all of a sudden is
absolutely
in that position.
And particularly the way we ran it. I was a bona fide player from 1973 until 1986, and certainly from then until 1989. So I had 16 years in that council, which is enough for anybody. And I didn't feel put upon because I only had three at the top. That's silly. I was as close as I needed to be for a long, long time.
I've come to the end of my list of notes, and the agenda that I had sent you, we've covered a good part of it. I just wanted to touch base on a few other things here. Scientific innovation, what does it mean to you as exemplified from your experience?
Well, I'm afraid that I am on the pragmatic side of that one. I love exploratory research in new areas. You mentioned tetracyanoethylene earlier. Started out to be a promising new monomer, but as soon as we learned that it didn't make a polymer, we still had a huge amount of fun with it. So I understand the joy of exploring this earth and its yet to be discovered secrets. But innovation to me is inevitably linked to society and to new products and or new services that are going to make society better or change the way in which we go about conducting our affairs. It has to be useful. It has to be commercially important. Or it's just a curiosity. That doesn't make it unimportant, because curiosity is, good fiction is important. There are lots of things that are important in life. But the innovation that I am really concerned about is the innovation that does change the way in which we conduct our affairs physically. And that's new products and new processes and whole new sciences and whole new markets, but always linked to something that somebody in the street gets some benefit from. And how you make people innovative is a very interesting question.
That was my next one.